Flying is the worst one because people come back from flights and they tell you their story. And it's like a horror story. It's they act like their flight was like a cattle car in the 40s in Germany. That's how bad they make it sound.
Right.
They're like, it was the worst day of my life. First of all, we didn't board for 20 minutes. Right. And then we get on the plane and they made us sit there on the runway for 40 minutes. We had to sit there. Oh, really? What happened next? Did you fly through the air incredibly like a bird? Did you partake in the miracle of human flight, you non-contributing zero? That you got to fly? You're flying! It's amazing! Everybody on every plane should just constantly be going, oh my God! Wow!
Yes!
You're flying. You're sitting in a chair in the sky.
Yes. Yeah. Yeah.
This is Infants on Thrones.
Minisode.
I recently took a trip to the Outer Banks of North Carolina, which includes, among other things, the town of Kitty Hawk. While there, we decided to take a short day trip to the Wright Brothers National Monument. I would have already known this if I'd really bothered to research it before, but the Wright Brothers came from incredibly humble beginnings. Born in Dayton, Ohio, neither of them ever graduated from high school. They went on to own first a printing press of their own construction and then a bicycle shop where they repaired and later constructed bicycles of their own. As adults, their long-standing passion for flight began to take shape, and they began to read the reports of other flight enthusiasts and participate in the community themselves. Using only the meager earnings and tools from their bicycle shop business, they began to create kites and gliders of their own, and due to its consistent wind, sandy soil for soft landings, and relative isolation, they chose Kitty Hawk, North Carolina as their testing ground. For a few months out of each year, they'd make the multi-day journey from Ohio to the Outer Banks to test their craft, and they started to experience some success. However, the largest hurdle still eluded them, self-powered controlled flight. They just couldn't get any of their creations to work that way. Utterly discouraged, they were on the brink of giving up when the realization came to them. All the work they had done had been based on research and conclusions drawn by other flight researchers. But the whole field of study was relatively new. Nobody really knew anything. So how could they trust the work of others? It was in this moment that, despite their lack of formal education, they distinguished themselves as true scientists. Because rather than giving up or carrying on as before, they decided to view everything reported in other attempts at flight with deep skepticism. Anything that they couldn't personally verify through experimentation wasn't going into the design. They were going to build their understanding from the ground up, brick by brick. So, with this renewed determination, they began again, and along the way, many important discoveries emerged. Using their own wind tunnel, one of the first ever constructed, and a meticulous method of trial, measurement, and evaluation, they calculated a mathematical formula for lift that is nearly identical to what is used in aviation software algorithms to this day. They also commissioned the first ever aluminum cast engine block to power their apparatus, as well as solidified the mathematical expression of why propellers work, which had yet to be explicitly stated despite the fact that the U.S. Navy had been using propeller technology for years. But after years of arduous labor, their backs were against the wall. Multiple mechanical setbacks had transpired while other, better financed, more educated researchers continued to close in on creating a working aircraft, and the window of favorable weather for testing that year was narrowing as winter set in. Finally, they reached a breaking point. It was now or never. So, on a blustery December afternoon in 1903, they put their little biplane on the wooden guidance track and fired up the engine. But because of the weight limitations, the engine had no radiator and therefore could only be run for a few consecutive minutes before overheating, so they were on a short timetable. Their first attempt was promising, but failed to reach the commonly accepted milestone of being airborne for 300 consecutive feet needed to count as flying. The second attempt went even further, but failed to reach the mark. Time was running out. Finally, on their third attempt, their aircraft, under its own power, left the ground, leveled off, and sailed through the air for a momentous 852 feet, ushering in the age of human flight.
It's historic moment in aviation as Amelia Earhart Putnam adds another first to her long list of achievements as a pretty pioneer of the air.
This airplane and this pilot are about to be the first ever to fly faster than the speed of sound in level flight.
Where does it fly to?
I don't know.
It flies north. You can hightail it on Eastern's new 727 jetliner to Washington, Philadelphia, and Boston. And a unique new dining service is worth writing home about.
Today, a new moon is in the sky, a 23-inch metal sphere placed in orbit by a Russian rocket.
I'm going to step off the landing. That's one small step for man, one giant leap for mankind.
The start of a journey that would take Voyager 1 to the very edge of our solar system and beyond.
Farther into the solar system than ever before.
The spacecraft is now the first human-made object to have left the vicinity of our sun and entered a completely new region of space.
As I stood on that runway and contemplated the profound impact on humanity of what had taken place there, all the aspects of Mormonism that I've defined myself by in one way or another for so long, like who could get married to who, and temple attendance, and home teaching, and drinking coffee, seemed so small. Even the parts beyond the rules and technicalities, the doctrines and teachings I'd once found as such poignant examples of pure objective truth started to feel so narrow and one-dimensional and obviously mired in the ideals of the culture they came from in comparison to what that first flight represented for human history. That isn't to say that one somehow negates the other. I just find the idea that Mormonism's assertions of truth are somehow more important or carry greater implications for the human race than what the Wright brothers discovered absurd. In just 100 years, the discoveries made by these two uneducated, unrelenting, brilliant Midwestern bicycle repairmen have reached a state of transcendence beyond anything Mormonism ever has. Their contribution to our collective knowledge has truly rolled out like a stone cut without hands to fill the whole earth, regardless of differences in cultural upbringing, ultimately allowing mankind to accomplish feats once considered the impossible daydreams of madmen. The Wright brothers made gods of all of us, right here, in this life. And when that realization dawned on me, for the first time in many, many years, I felt like I was standing on sacred ground. In addition to the visitor center and runway, the Wright Brothers National Memorial also includes a 60-foot 1930s-style granite monument on top of Kill Devil Hill, the hill from which they performed many of their experiments. The inscription around the monument's base reads, "In commemoration of the conquest of the air by the brothers Wilbur and Orville Wright, conceived by genius, achieved by dauntless resolution and unconquerable faith." When I first read this, I admit I was a bit skeptical of the use of the word faith. Faith, I thought, faith had nothing to do with it. It was science. Science is about knowledge, not faith. But as I thought about it more, the words seemed more and more appropriate. What else could you call their unshakable resolve to test and measure and try again and again and again, if not the evidence of things hoped for but not seen? However, the faith of the Wright brothers was very different than the faith that led me to take Mormonism so seriously all those years. See, my faith had been sort of a top-down model. I was taught what was right or good, and faith stepped in as some sort of stopgap when the predetermined conclusion of the way things were didn't seem to match up with the evidence or my own moral compass. My faith was rooted in the source of the information I was getting, and what came from that source was true in spite of all the evidence to the contrary. I just had to have faith that eventually the reality I perceived would reconcile somehow with the incongruent ideas I was holding in my head. The Wright brothers' faith, on the other hand, was rooted in the method they followed for establishing truth, rather than any one specific source like I was. They viewed all assertions of how it was with a hefty dose of skepticism, and any assertion that didn't stand the test of independent empirical verification was discarded without reservation. This allowed the evidence to drive their conclusions, rather than the eventually the evidence will line up with this foregone conclusion and it'll all make sense kind of relationship that I'd had with Mormonism. Now, a lot of people seem to think that being skeptical means that you're cynical, but that wasn't true of the Wright brothers at all. Their disposition to never, ever stop wondering and doubting and questioning showed that underlying their incredulity was an ironclad thread of optimism that if they tested enough alternatives, the answer would eventually be revealed and they could step into the blinding light of discovery. With that in mind, I'd like to bear my testimony. I know that the scientific method is true. And by true, I mean that I know that applying it with exactness will unequivocally bring a greater understanding of the world around us. I believe all that scientific inquiry has revealed, all that scientific inquiry now reveals, and I believe that scientific inquiry will yet reveal many great and important things pertaining to the nature of the universe. I know that, just as the Wright brothers unlocked the mystery of human flight and allowed mankind to break free of the force that binds us to the Earth's surface, as we remain skeptical of the answers we've been given and optimistic for the answers we can discover, we too can stand on the shoulders of the giants that came before us and reach even greater heights. And that, to me, is salvation. That is exaltation. That is the vision of humanity that I subscribe to. Not a fallen being in need of redemption, but an ascendant testament to the majesty of sentience and critical thought. Sure, we're not perfect, far from it. But I know that through continued dedication to the scientific method, many great discoveries still await us. That we can find the collective wisdom to use these discoveries to help alleviate human suffering and improve the human condition is my humble prayer. In the name of the frontal lobe, amen.
Spread your love and life. Hi, this is Hillary from Normal, Illinois. And I'm a public librarian who every other day sees groups of missionaries come in and sit only 10 feet away from the 289s, which is where all the fun books on Mormonism live for you fuckers who never go to the library. You can comment on this episode on the website, infantsonthrones.com, and if you really like what you hear, give the Quorum a 5-star rating and write a short review on iTunes. I did. Anyone for the closing prayer? God rest his soul. Lord of mercy.